Art, Print and Artwork, recorded by Conrad Taylor on the 3rd of January 2013. In my previous auto-biocast in November 2012, I talked about my early fascination with printed reproduction using spirit duplicators, or bander machines as we called them, and stencil duplicators, such as the Gestetner or Ronio machines. Today I'm extending that story to tell how I came to engage with three other reprographic methods which were capable of presenting a richer mix of content because they could integrate large and small type, shading, illustration, even photographs. Those three methods were electrostencil duplication, proper offset lithographic printing, and to a lesser extent, dry toner photocopying or xerography. What all three had in common was that you started by getting together an assembled original image which we called artwork. In the case of lithoprinting, sometimes it was called CRC or camera-ready copy, because the artwork was going to be photographed using a repro camera onto big sheets of film as part of the plate-making process. Strangely enough, to this day, some folks in publishing still refer to camera-ready copy, even though the artwork is now 100% electronic and there are no cameras involved at all. Now, in my last presentation, I did mention how you could already do some ingenious things by mixing typewriter text, hand-lettered headlines, and line drawings done with a ballpoint pen on a bander spirit duplicating master, which was good fun. But for a long time, these creative affordances didn't apply to stencil duplicating, which is actually the duplicating technology of choice if you wanted longer print runs at lower cost. But that changed with the invention of the electrostencil scanner. I first met these machines through the student Christian movement. I used to travel down to SCM HQ for meetings, at first in the big house called Annandale in Golders Green in North London, and later at Wick Court in the countryside between Bath and Bristol. Wick Court was the slightly tatty Jacobean mansion house into which we moved the SCM headquarters in the mid-70s. The staff lived there as an experiment in communal living. When we bought it, it had a paint factory attached on one side, which we converted into a residential conference centre. The headquarters equipment included at least one IBM Executive Model D typewriter capable of knocking out proportionally spaced type, the letter L being two-fifths the width of the letter M, for example. Of course, it could do this only in one size of type. There were also two Ronio stencil duplicators, one of which had interchangeable print drums for black, red, or green printing. And there was a scanning machine that contained a horizontal cylindrical drum about half a metre long and slightly less in circumference, which could spin about its axis. This was the electrostencil scanner. The left half of the drum was wrapped around with a flexible transparent plastic cover, under which you would insert and clamp an original image that you'd prepared on a sheet of paper, not too thick, ideally in stark black and white. So, for example, any typewriting should be done with a one-time-only carbon film ribbon, not the usual fabric one. Around the right half of the drum, you would then mount a blank stencil, not the waxy surfaced sort I was used to typing onto, and which I described in my last autobiocast. This kind was made of a thin, matte black material impregnated with carbon. Once the scanner was loaded, you moved the scanning head, which rode on a bar mounted above and parallel to the cylinder, to the extreme left side of the drum, its starting position, and you started the scanner running with a press of a button. The cylindrical drum began to spin very fast. The scanning head lit up and started slowly advancing from left to right. The head contained a lamp, a lens, and a photocell, so it could peer at each tiny part of the artwork as it span beneath, and determine whether it was black or white. Now, some 25 centimetres to the right of this scanning head, moving in lockstep with it, there was a hair-thin wire electrode sticking out, if you like, tickling the carbon-coated surface of the stencil spinning beneath. Whenever the photocell detected black on the artwork, the electrode responded with an electric spark that burned right through the carbon-blocking material of the stencil, creating a porous hole that ink could seep through when it was mounted on the duplicator. It was a rather horrible, flattened, dusty burning smell which came from the burning carbon. I'm sure it can't have been all that good for our lungs. The pattern of sparking by the electrode also made an indescribable whispering, chuntering sound, which changed in its rhythm and texture in response to the pattern of artwork content which the photocell was detecting. You know, I wish it was possible to find that sound, because I'm sure it would bring back memories for anyone who ever used one of these devices. Anyway, what this device gave us was a stencil that could be mounted onto the print drum of the duplicator to produce inexpensively duplicated documents with big headlines, cartoons, maps, and so on. We used it in SCM in producing the small circulation journal called Communique, which was sent out to SCM branches around the country. Each one consisted of about 70 to 90 pages. Different sections were printed on different coloured stock, and it was stapled in three places down the side using an industrial-powered stapler. Bam! 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 This is also how I got to learn how to use various new technologies and methods for preparing the artwork originals. For example, Letraset, sheets of rubbed-down dry transfer lettering for making headlines with. Fortunately, the scanner photocell was quite blind in the blue end of the spectrum, so you could draw a thin line with a light blue pencil and use that as a guide for aligning the next letter with the previously done letters before burnishing it down onto the paper, ideally with something not too pointy. In fact, there was a special implement made by Letraset for the job, though I tended to use the rounded end of a scalpel handle. Now, the reason there was a scalpel around anyway was because it would be really tempting fate to apply the lettering direct to your artwork in case you made a mistake. It made much better sense to prepare the headlines beforehand on separate pieces of thin, smooth paper, then cut each one out neatly with a sharp blade and glue that onto the artwork. American practice was to use either an X-Acto craft knife or a single-edged stiff razor blade. But in Britain we used Swan Morton medical scalpels, a flat brass handle with a scalpel blade clipped into it. My preference was for the long tapered straight edge of a number 11 blade, while others used the stubbier number 10A. And what about the adhesive? Well, you couldn't use a water-based glue such as PVA because that would seep into the paper fibres and wrinkle them. You could use a Pritt stick at a pinch, but it tended to go lumpy. The ideal adhesive was a rubber cement, that is to say, latex dissolved and thinned with a solvent, N-heptane or N-hexane. That kind of solvent doesn't wrinkle the paper, and when the gum is fully dried, it makes a very strong bond. Americans and Asians, I've subsequently found, preferred a more liquid version of rubber cement, with a higher proportion of solvents in it, so liquid indeed it could be applied with a brush. Though in 1987, when I visited the offices of the Thai newspaper, The Nation, the art workers were applying it with their fingers. One approach used in America was to apply a thin coating both to the base artwork sheet and to the back of what you are going to mount onto it. Let both sides dry, then bring them into contact with each other for an immediate strong bond. But in Britain, we used gloppier stuff called cow gum. It came in red and white tins. You'd take the artwork element that you trimmed out with your scalpel, place it face down on some clean scrap paper, dip the spatula about 4 millimetres into the open tin of gum, and coat the back of the artwork element up to, indeed right over the edge of the element, onto the scrap paper in every direction until the whole piece was covered in a thin mucus of cow gum. And there was quite an art to doing this without your nice delicate piece of letter setting or whatever slipping under your fingers across the scrap paper and picking up some gum on the art side. If you then gently dab the back of the wet gummed piece with the edge of your spatula, you could pick it cleanly out of the surrounding gum-covered scrap sheet, turn it over, and place it on the artwork. For about the next 2 minutes, the gum would still be slippery enough to let you make microscopic adjustments to its location, square it up just where you wanted it, checking with a T-square or a set square, then cover with a sheet of something like tracing paper, and either rub it down firmly or use a small roller. And this was the art of paste-up, British style. Incidentally, many years afterwards, at a gathering of the Designers and Health Network, the topic of cow gum came up in discussion, much to the horror of Lakshmi Shyamsunder, who, as a good Hindu, was horrified that we should be using glue made out of cows. We had to reassure her it was made out of rubber. And my understanding is it got its strange name from the original manufacturer of the stuff, one Mr. Henry Cow, who also got his name hijacked by the avant-garde rockers Fred Frith and Tim Hodgkinson when they named their band Henry Cow in 1968. And so, as a graphic designer of this period, you'd spend much of your day in a solvent-laden fug of N-heptane fumes, It was a good idea to spread some cowgum on a metal or glass surface, wait till it dried, then roll it up into an ovoid ball looking not unlike a large gobbet of half-dried snot. This was useful for picking up any bits of stray, dried cowgum that had squeezed out from under the edges of your artwork elements as you burnished them down, and had got smeared onto the surface of the artwork. Other designers used aerosol cans of spray mount as an adhesive, usually without benefit of a proper spray booth, of course. I severely disapproved of that stuff. It gets everywhere. So that's how we prepared artwork for the electrostencil scanner, and with some adjustments, it's also how we made the camera-ready artwork for lithographic printing. The artwork, which we sent off to the print works, where it got photographed with a repro camera in the process of making the lithographic printing plates for proper print jobs. In 1975, or thereabouts, I went to live at the SCM headquarters and staff commune at Wick Court. I lived in a shed next to their hen house and worked as an office volunteer. This is when I graduated to preparing artwork for proper offset lithographic printing for the SCM National magazine called Movement. I think it was bimonthly, about 24, 28 or 32 pages, sometimes with a themed supplement inserted, and a print run of several thousand. It was properly typeset and contained illustrations and photographs, black and white, but often with a spot colour accent on the covers. The editors and production team were Richard Zipfel, whom I believe now works with the Catholic Association for Racial Justice, and Viv Broughton, at one time a drummer with The Pretty Things, who now runs a recording studio in Hackney and is an authority on the history of gospel music. I must look them up someday. It was under Viv's guidance that I learned how to do artwork properly. As I recall, the edited copy as typescript was sent off for phototypesetting somewhere in the Bristol area and came back as strips or rolls of processed bromide paper. I'm not going to say more today about my involvement with typesetting. That came a bit later, and it would better fit into another of my life stories anyway. All I'll say for now is that at that time, photosetting machines generally couldn't stretch to headline sizes of type, so we still used Letraset for that. From which there comes a salutary tale. We'd laid out a special edition of Movement on gay liberation theology. We letrosetted all the headlines, we created an ad for books on the back cover, we sent it off, and back from the printers came several thousand copies advertising we SCM pubications in 1-inch high letters on the back. Ah! It was also in this period that I perfected my brush and ink cartooning and illustration style, strongly influenced by the woodcut line art style of Eric Gill, but also by cartoonists Trog and Ron Cobb. The line work in my illustrations was robust and high contrast. It was a style that I developed to work within the limitations of electrostencil scanners, but it also turned out to be highly suitable for offset litho reproduction and photocopiers too. The shading in my illustrations was often executed by hatching and cross-hatching lines, drawn with a tube-nib technical pen, 0.35 or 0.25 millimetres, such as a rotring pen. Now, I also learned how to use Letratone. This was a thin shading film, transparent but printed with patterns of dots, lines or other shading patterns, and it had a mild adhesive on the back. You'd cut out a bit slightly larger than you needed, you stuck it lightly at first on your illustration, then trimmed off the unwanted bits with a really sharp scalpel and rubbed it down hard to make it secure. For electrostencil work, I generally had to make my illustrations same size. For litho printing, where there was a slightly larger budget to play with, I learned to draw cartoons at size and a half or even double size. We then sent the illustrations off to the printers. They would use their repro camera to shoot high-quality, dead-sharp photographic copies on Kodak PMT, or Agfa copy-proof, instant photographic materials. These are diffusion transfer materials, similar in principle to Polaroids, and resized exactly as you had instructed. We then pasted those resized bromide copies onto the artwork. You see, by working larger to start with, any little mistakes I made would shrink to insignificance. Another nifty trick you could do with a repro camera was to convert continuous tone grayscale photos into copies which were not only resized, but had also been converted, or screened as we called it, into a half-tone pattern of high contrast, equally spaced dots of variable diameter. The point of all these half-toning and screening processes is that litho printing cannot do true continuous tone grey, because ink is either there on the plate or it's not. But by using a very fine screen pattern, you get the illusion of grayscale that is undetectable by the naked eye. All the photos we used on Movement magazine were pre-screened like this and pasted up onto the artwork along with everything else. Much later, in 1986, when my wife Noy and I set up our own little design and translation business, Ideography, we bought our own Danograph 602MS repro camera, a whacking big thing, with copyboard and film back larger than A2, and it stood chest high in its own darkroom where we lived in Manchester. I really loved the repro camera and all the tricks you could do with it, but now I'm messing up my chronology, so let's back up a bit. When I moved to London and started working for Luz, as I related in a previous autobiocast, preparing publications for print was one of my main responsibilities. Between 1977 and 1979, I worked in Oxford for the development campaign Third World First, and there I was principally responsible for editing and artworking their membership magazine, Lynx. In fact, not only did I write much of Lynx, illustrate it and lay out the pages, but also for the first 2 years we actually litho-printed it in-house too. Yes, we had our own tabletop press. It does sound mad now, but remember that plain paper photocopiers were at that time ridiculously expensive to run, so organisations like ours used stencil duplicators, or, if you aspired to better quality or longer print runs, as we did at Third or First, you'd get a small A4 litho press like our AB Dick machine. Now, I haven't said much yet about using plain paper photocopiers, but in the late 70s, a group of Thai activists and their British supporters like me were promoting a Thai film, Tong Pan, at the Edinburgh Film Festival. We used a photocopying bureau to produce a small number of sets of documentation, and I got the job of preparing the artwork. Now, the photocopiers of that era illuminated any artwork you placed on the platen with a travelling fluorescent tube that lit the art from one side. This tended to cast a small shadow mark on the far side of anything that you'd pasted onto the artwork base. These copiers also couldn't do large areas of black at all well. I think the electrostatic selenium coating on the imaging drum tended to dissipate its charge in those large areas, and they'd fade out towards the centre. I therefore had to make my artwork with very thin materials, and as for the headlines, for once I carefully letter-setted them straight onto the base sheet. I then covered the headlines with strips of white letter-tone overlaying a pattern of thin white lines, thus reducing them to a screened pattern that didn't suffer from that fading-out problem of large solids. You know, you always have to find out the limitations of your means and work within them. It's one of my life principles. Speeding up my story now. In 1979, I left Third World First. I went to Thailand and Malaysia for about 5 months. I came back and started running another small litho press, a secretary to the veteran peace campaigner, Peggy Duff. Then I dropped out of paid work for a while. I lived with a Trinidadian lady, and for a couple of years I looked after her two children and her house in Charlton, the London Borough of Greenwich. But I was getting involved in community action projects and in the Law Centres movement. I designed a number of publications for groups of this sort, prepared them for print, and negotiated with the printers. I also ran a course at the local Adult Education Institute about design and print for community groups. And I got enrolled as a so-called ad hoc student, that is a non-qualifying student, at Goldsmiths College in South London, running around with a pack of postgraduates. And after that, they gave me a part-time job as a tutor technician in the letterpress area. In 1983, I set up my own wee design studio above a photo typesetting shop in Lewisham's Loam Pit Vale, servicing the print needs of small community organisations. And while I was based there, I became aware of a specialist supplier of graphic equipment, a firm called Rotaboard, based in Bridge North in Shropshire, run by former civil engineer Colin Ringrose. Now, Colin had a working arrangement with an American printer and inventor from Omaha, Nebraska, called Walter Graham. Walter was the author of The Complete Art of Paste-Up, and he'd done a very careful study of how to reduce the inefficiencies in this very labour-intensive part of the publishing and printing process. He advocated the use of molten wax dispensed from a handheld machine as a better adhesive than rubber cement, especially when pasting up the bromide output from photosetting machines and repro cameras. And he devised a system of accelerated paste-up using a light box for rear illumination of small transparent Perspex drawing boards. Well, I became a proponent and advocate of the Walter Graham system, and I was probably one of the most efficient paster-uppers in the land. Walter used to come over and run seminars in the UK about his artwork preparation methods, seminars which Colin Ringrose organised for him, as well as selling his specialist paste-up equipment, some of which I bought. Anyway, through that contact, I got pulled into becoming a trainer for the publishing training company, Popular Communication Courses, that was established in 1984 between Colin Ringrose and Björn Carlson of Sweden. But that is yet another story. Now, when Noy and I got together and married, I think that was 1985, I showed her the Graham system and the other stuff that I'd learned. She's already pretty good at design and photography anyway, and in her own language, she was a very good writer and editor. Then, and I think this was through friends at the London School of Oriental and African Studies, I was contacted by Larry Jagan and Tony Kahane, who were just setting up a radical magazine of Asian politics called Inside Asia. Noy and I became members of the Inside Asia Workers Co-op, job-sharing the typographic design, layout and production roles. I focused on typography management, while Noy solved the layout jigsaw puzzle and determined how photos would be cropped, scaled and placed. And we both did production paste-up and imposition of the final camera-ready artwork, and then sent it off to the North London Printing Cooperative called Spiderweb, which operated in the Finsbury Park area. At the same time, Noy and I had inherited, in a manner of speaking, responsibility for the Thai community magazine Thai Europe. This had previously been run by Noy's sister, Yi, and Yi's then husband, the photographer Tanya Ponanan, whom I'd already known for some years, even before I met Noy, when Tanya was living in Sweden. So that meant that Noy and I were also doing artwork for Thai Europe as well. Now, I was friends with the women's print co-op in New Cross, just down the road from Lewisham, called Rye Express. They kindly gave us copies of the keys to their premises. Noy and I would turn up there at dead of night and run their Agfa copy-proof process camera well into the early hours of the morning to shoot all the bromides and screen all of the photographs that we needed for either Inside Asia or Thai Europe magazine. I think that's as far as I want to take my story today about my involvement with print and with paste-up, because that takes us up to 1985, and that was the year that Noy and I first encountered and became excited by the Macintosh computer and desktop publishing technology. And that is definitely another story for another day. But not only are my memories of those pre-DTP methods of preparing artwork still incredibly vivid, I still have my box of Swan Morton scalpels, and as a related memento, a slight mark on my left forefinger showing where a number 11 scalpel blade feasted on my blood early one morning before a print deadline. It took 4 stitches at Greenwich Hospital to sew that one up. "My God, man, what did you do that with?" said the doctor on A&E. "Number 11, Swan and Morton blade, same as you use," said I. Now, red, as far as the print process is concerned, is equivalent to black. Any red is going to register as a print mark, so I hope you'll appreciate it as a mark of the professional, none of my blood ended up on the artwork.